You're listening to TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
TalkZone.com.
Welcome to How to Tour Italy with your host, Anthony Capozzoli. Anthony's passion for Italy is contagious. His dream is to bring Italy to life for people everywhere and to help them embrace the wonderful Italian lifestyle at home. Now, with How to Tour Italy, let's welcome travel expert, guidebook author, photographer, and radio host, Anthony Capozzoli.
Hi, this is Anthony Capozzoli with the How to Tour Italy radio show, and I am sitting here in an outdoor cafe in Florence. Things are shutting down. You can hear doors slamming in the background with Mr. Neil Atkinson. He is a tour guide here in Florence and an academic. He's just finishing up his PhD here in Florence, and we're sitting in front of the Demi Cafe enjoying these wonderful shakarato. We kind of came back here to the scene of the crime. We've done other interviews here. We came back here because we love the shakarato so much. And with that, thank you for being on the show, Neil.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. And the reason Neil is on the show, well, a couple things. One, he is a tour guide with Context Travel, number one. Number two, he's an academic and an expert. And I'm going to let him kind of talk a little bit about his own background. But we were able to enjoy a wonderful tour with Neil as our guide of the Vasari Corridor, one of the gems here in Florence that many people do not kind of take time to go see. So with that, let's talk a little bit about, you know, who Neil is and have him explain his background a little bit. So with that, Neil, let's talk a little bit about your background and kind of where you come from academically.
Sure. No, thank you. I just completed a PhD at Cornell University in architecture, history of architecture and urban planning. And I consider myself an architectural and urban historian, and my specialty is Florentine urban history in the late, primarily the late 14th, early 15th century. And what I'm interested in really is how Florentines experience their city on a daily basis at the threshold of the Renaissance. A lot of architectural work has gone into considering how buildings and cities get built,
sure,
who the architects are, the kind of design work that goes into that. What I'm interested in is kind of confronting that with how people actually experience their built environment to kind of get a dialogue going between the production and consumption of architecture.
That's great. And I tell you, it was wonderful on the tour when you described that, because at the beginning, we met at this wonderful cafe in Piazza Signoria. And let me say that tongue-in-cheek. It's a great meeting place, but it's not a place to sit down and order an espresso or a shakarato.
Exactly right. Don't sit down with whatever you're thinking.
It's very expensive to do so. We'd forgotten where we were at. I actually ordered two shakarato and a bottle of water, and when the bill came, I'm like, oh, that's right, we're in Piazza Signoria.
If you're on a budget, you always stand in Italy. That's just the rule,
exactly,
of thumb. Yeah.
That's a good point. But the tour was great because you kicked things off. We actually went into the loggia, and it was wonderful. We sat down. I think we stood there and talked for about 15, 20 minutes and gave us this wonderful background about not only the Medici's, and everyone knows, loves, and or hates the Medici family, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny. Maybe if it's okay to kind of reintroduce the concept of how you study them. From an art history perspective, people love them. And then from a political science perspective, people kind of hate them. It's true.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword, this family. I mean, they came to prominence at the end of the 14th, beginning of the 15th century, and they amassed a huge fortune, primarily through banking, but also through textile production, which are the two economic engines driving the city at the end of the Middle Ages, beginning of the Renaissance, and what really is the economic underpinnings of what we consider to be the Renaissance. And here you have then a family who is using its power and wealth to undermine a very complicated series of republican institutions set up by Florentines to govern their city as an autonomous republic,
mm-hmm,
in order to accrue power to themselves. For political historians, therefore, there's a constant antagonism between the Medici trying to undermine this republic and what it stands for its 250-year
sure,
period, and their patronage of the arts, where they became brilliant manipulators politically of patronage of architecture, painting, sculpture, you name it. They became great collectors of cultural objects, and so they were, I mean, the most prominent family behind this sort of revolution, right, in the plastic arts that we call the Renaissance, as a way of sort of founding a legacy here for themselves that would last, of course, until tonight, as we're talking to them,
right,
talking about them right now. And so you have this double-edged sword. They were destroying the very foundations upon which the Renaissance was based.
Right.
It's Republican political system. At the same time, they were massive innovators at the same time of that very revolution.
And that's great. And the thing is, when this is described with Neil and so masterfully done, standing in the loggia, it's wonderful because you're surrounded by a lot of these artworks that have been created on that side of the fence, and you're looking into this wonderful Piazza Signoria, obviously. And it's wonderful not only when you come and visit Florence. It's one of those, for me, I'm tied between these three piazzas for me. Piazza Signoria being one of my favorites, Piazza Navona in Rome, and I love Campo, Piazza del Campo in Siena.
I think you've named three of the most important urban spaces in all of Italy, if not Europe. I mean, I'm, of course, Florentine centrist, so I mean, I have my arguments, but they truly are. I mean, Piazza Navona is a little bit different because it comes later, although it's based on antique foundations. The Piazza della Signoria and Piazza del Campo in Siena are both medieval constructions. All of them, though, are places where people naturally tend to seem comfortable to hang out in, and that's the whole point of the piazza. It is both. I mean, for all of these spaces, their political resonance has pretty much died. Their social resonance still exists in a transformed way because people are constantly interacting socially, which is part of why they were there. And they're also sort of spectacles for the kind of image that those cities wanted to represent to the people in them, right? Especially in Siena and Florence, where the image of the of the government represented by its public palace was meant to be seen exactly the way you see it coming into that square.
Yeah.
And so that when we were looking out of that square, we saw all the space itself where the citizens would gather to watch their government in action, and we also saw the individual pieces of sculpture that were there, right, which were in dialogue with themselves. What I didn't point out when we were talking there was that all of the sculptures have political resonances, mm-hmm. as well as artistic ones. And there's a constant game back and forth between what those sculptures mean and how they interact together. For example, Michelangelo's famous David stands right next to the entrance to the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence. It was meant to be put there by the government. And he's looking towards his left, and he's looking, which means he's looking south. When that sculpture was placed there in 1504, the government was a government that had kicked the Medici out into exile in 1494. By 1504, they had suffered three military campaigns by the Medici to re-enter the city, and so the David became a kind of symbol, right, of anti-Medici loyalty with the Republic in keeping the Medici out. David, of course, is ready to kill the great giant Goliath. The Goliath was then interpreted as the Medici trying to re-enter the city, and so here you have a highly politicized monument staring down the Medici. Now, of course, right next to the David is the Hercules and Cacus,
right,
which was put there in the 1530s by the first Duke of Florence. In 1530, Florence is no longer a republic. The dukes are now in charge. There's no more councils. There's no more sort of collective city building within Florence. And you have a situation where the Medici, who have newly arrived as dukes, they cannot take the David down, even though they know that it's a monument confronting their authority. Because the Florentines would just go bonkers because they loved the David. And so, in a way, the Bandinelli's Hercules and Cacus becomes a kind of counter point against the stare of David down south to Rome where the Medici were.
Right.
And he, of course, has a club in his hand, and he's beating into submission Cacus, who, according to ancient myths, stole his cattle.
Right.
However, that sculpture was interpreted by Florentines as Medici, as Hercules, clubbing Florentine liberty into submission. And so at night they would attach anonymous poems to it, ridiculing both the sculpture and the sculpture itself as a way of indirectly criticizing the government, which you couldn't do directly anymore.
Right.
And so
poor
Bandinelli and his sculpture of Hercules have suffered throughout the centuries because they are constantly at war with Michelangelo's David, which is the most beloved sculpture in this city, and if not Western Europe,
for example.
And so it is only recently that that sculpture has been taken seriously by art historians themselves. So there you have, just next to that, under the lodge where we were standing, we were just looking at the backside of the Perseus by Benvenuto Cellini, which is, I think, was unveiled sometime in the 1550s or so. And by that point, the Republic was a sort of a distant memory, and you have a court artist like Cellini, who is a goldsmith, who creates this wonderful bronze, life-size bronze sculpture of Perseus holding up the head of the severed head of the Medusa, of the Gorgon.
Yeah.
And he wanted his sculpture to be right where it stands today. We know that for sure. And so there's an argument, this is made by a professor, late professor John Sherman of Harvard. When you stand in the middle of the piazza, you see David, who originally was looking south to the Medici. And then you see Cacus, who's looking in a similar direction. When you look at them both in the middle of the piazza, they both look like they're looking at Perseus.
Yeah.
And Perseus is confronting them with the head of the Gorgon. And of course, when you show the head of the Gorgon, you turn to stone.
Right. Right.
And that was the point. When Perseus takes out the head of the Gorgon to prove that he killed the Gorgon, everyone in the room turns to stone. And in a way, Cellini knew then, we think, that you would look at Perseus, his bronze sculpture, turning to stone the sculptures of his rivals, of his forebears, his fathers, so to speak, his artistic fathers, Michelangelo and Bandinelli, by the beauty of his bronze sculpture. And so what that does is two things,
awesome.
Right? It creates this wonderful sort of artistic dialogue within the piazza of the sculpture. At the same time, it diffuses the politics that those original stone sculptures were meant to play. And so you're taking away this, the acrimony that they sort of represented, and turning it the square into the sculpture garden it is today. And it's a brilliant game.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I hadn't considered that.
And, of course, the lodge itself was a place of political meeting, a place where the government would be on show, the citizens in the square watching their government welcome foreign ambassadors. But, of course, you can't do that.
Sure.
You don't want to do that when you're the Medici, because you don't have the wherewithal to do so, because that's why you built the... Sorry, I'm losing myself.
That's okay.
That's why the Vasari Corridor was built in a way to hide government. The loggia became a sculpture garden for the very reason that the government no longer wanted to be on display. It wanted its propaganda on display in the form of sculpture and decoration and whatnot, but it in of itself had to hide behind what it was structures like the Vasari Corridor.
And that was kind of the fascinating thing about the Vasari Corridor, I thought, that I was unaware of this, but how intricately the architecture of it played into that kind of political use, where you'd mentioned that one side the windows are large and you could see out of and are very comfortable, and the other side they're almost like portals in a ship where they're limited view in and perfect view out.
Exactly. I think the Vasari Corridor represents one of those rare instances of what I would consider an almost perfect architecture. It has to fulfill two different functions which are at odds with each other. And therefore, its interior performs a function which is wholly distinct from its exterior. And so you have a corridor which is, in essence, really a perfect private street. A perfect sort of corridor between the Palazzo Vecchio, the center of government, and the Palazzo Pitti, the suburban residence of the Dukes. And so that they could get between those two centers of the city without anyone knowing they were doing so very quickly, and especially when the river flooded. But you know, they always had access to the two parts of the city. So what you have is, in a way, on the inside, those windows towards the river were to allow sort of an accessible view into the city. The small portholes to the city side allowed them to look and see what their citizens were doing as a form of surveillance. At the same time, it meant that the city really couldn't look back because of those small windows didn't allow access, right, for this sort of a reversed view back into what the Dukes were doing.
And it was amazing, because I was lucky enough a few days after our wonderful tour in the corridor to take a look from a view that you don't often get, which is on the Arno itself. We took a boat tour, which is wonderful. And looking in, we looked on both sides. One side, clear view with those big, beautiful windows. And the other side, you didn't even really notice that there were any windows at all. So it did play along. And you'd mentioned this perfect street. And you also, in the tour, I thought was brilliant. I thought about it quite a bit after, is the use of that for exchange of information. Always be one step ahead of kind of the network of information in the city with the use of that corridor, which I thought was amazing. You didn't really think of it that way. I kind of, in my mind, looked at it like a network or a DSL line, if you will, from a technology perspective, kind of high-speed internet access.
Sure.
So maybe if that's forgive me if that's a mundane way to put it, but
no, it's not. It's it was that kind of sort of access that was only open to certain users, right? Those who had the password had total access, and those who had the password had, of course, then the view out to the larger city, and those who didn't couldn't look back, and to those who didn't, the quarter represented a kind of architecture that began to dissolve into the city itself, so that even though you know it's there, it doesn't matter because you can't confront its gaze, and wherever you you do confront it, it is something, or it's pretending to be something else that it's not.
Yeah. Well, that was cool. I mean, there's two. I think my favorite examples, there are three wonderful examples, and kind of going backwards. The door exiting the Vasari corridor into the Palazzo Pitti grounds, I guess Boboli Gardens, it was so nondescript, it was almost unbelievable. I was shocked almost at how it looked like a closet door almost, for lack of a better term.
Absolutely. It's an architecture that is bereft of decoration, both inside and out, because its function... I think that in the terms of modern architecture, where form follows function, that modernist kind of dictum is, I think, here fully at play. It has to hide from the city and pretend it's something else. At the same time, it has to allow perfect access, free access inside, and therefore ornament, in this case, gets in the way. And so you get a very, very sort of pared-down architecture. It had to be built quickly, too. It was built in 8 months in 1565, which is an incredible feat. And it literally, in a way, sort of seamlessly almost, like marches right through the entire city. It walks over the Ponte Vecchio, literally, and sort of just rests on those workshops that are there before you even know it. And when you're walking on the Ponte Vecchio, you barely know there's a corridor, which is a separate entity above the workshops that you're shopping at, for example.
That's true. You do not really notice it. And I have been on Ponte Vecchio thousands of times. And if you don't consciously make a point to look up and see the corridor, you'll walk right by it and not even see it. And that's also true by the Uffizi. It's also true by Palazzo Pitti. And it's also true by the other piece of this, forgive me, I'm too much coffee here, but the church, Santa Felicita.
It's like here is the only facade designed by Vasari as an architect. Giorgio Vasari is the architect of the corridor. He's the court architect of Duke Cosimo, the primo. And... yeah, because the corridor goes over the Via dei Bardi across the Arno. It goes through an alleyway and ends up in a piazza in front of a church, which it's whose foundation dates back, I think, at least to the 4th or 5th century. And, of course, it sort of just melds itself into the facade of that church. So when you look at the corridor and you see the church, you automatically just assume that this is the facade of the church, which it is. But you forget that it belongs to a whole network.
Yes, it's amazing.
Of a corridor.
It does blend perfectly. You don't even notice it happening. And then the coolest part about when you're inside and in the corridor is the fact that you could see where the Dukes were able to go to church in Santa Felicita, unnoticed by the people at Mass, even the priest. I think maybe the priest could see them if he looked up and standing on the altar and looked up at one spot, if they were all the way up to the edge
of the balcony there. They may have, in fact, been able to see them. But I think it's a testament to just how insecure the original regime felt in the face of a city that had enjoyed that many centuries of independent self-rule, that this family, and these dukes had to hide themselves even when they were attending Mass. They could not be really present. So that for them, the Mass was still a part of a kind of a secret cult or something like that they could access from their quarter. Exactly.
Yeah, it was impressive. And then another thing that I thought was pretty cool, I actually went and looked up online the picture of Hitler and of Mussolini taken
It
was
it's from outside, where you look at them looking out the window. Exactly.
It was really kind of, we were standing literally looking out the exact window where that exact picture was taken. And it just seems kind of weird to be standing there in kind of a creepy way, to be tied to history that way, of course. But I don't know. Those two guys in history, say what you will about them and whatever. This is not that kind of. This is not a political show. But it just, I was like, we stood there in the exact spot where this picture was taken in the exact corridor. There's just something weird about that.
Well, it's a momentous thing because, I mean, here you have I think that... I'm not a certain expert on World War II history or Hitler or German fascism, but I mean, Hitler, I think, was really amazed by the city of Florence. And I think that that picture is I think, indicative, I think, of the way in which Hitler understood, right, his relationship to Florence.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether or not how widely that picture was circulated, but I mean, it may have to do with the fact that the bridge itself was not bombed by the Nazis when they were retreating from the Allies. It's interesting that he had an entire tour of the Uffizi, the way many people do today. He had an entire tour of the corridor, which some people also get to do today. And yet, when it came time for the Allies to retreat, and when they didn't bomb the bridge, which meant they didn't bomb the corridor, the Florentines remembered exactly the power of that corridor as a surveillance technique at a time before mass communication, at a time before electrification, and still in 1944, they were able to use the corridor to spy on the Nazis, who didn't then know that they were giving information to the Allies on their movements during the retreat.
It's amazing.
It's interesting that Hitler was there, and yet somehow they forgot, or didn't even became aware of what its potential value was militarily.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's... The corridor is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful addition to any itinerary here. And it's also filled, by the way, it's not just the corridor. I mean, it's wonderful in that regard as an architecture and politically speaking, but it's filled with these wonderful portraits along the way. Some of the most protected and most important portraits of the Medici collection.
Absolutely. The Medici, I have to give them credit.
Let me say something. I've way too much coffee. Medici.
Medici.
I just mispronounced. This is probably
the biggest
here,
mispronunciation problem that people have coming to Florence. You have to think of the Medici, when you're saying their name, as with the word medicine. It's like that. It's Medici.
Right.
The problem, of course, is when you use it as an adjective, this is a tangent, you pronounce it the other way. So it's not, when you say the Medici chapels, it's the Cappelle Medici, not the Cappelle Medici, which to me doesn't make any sense either, but that's how it is. So it's a very confusing thing.
Yeah.
But it's Medici.
That's right.
And I have to give them credit because regardless of how you feel about them politically and the political situation after the establishment of Florence as a duchy rather than a republic, and you have this absolutist government, the Medici had always been and continued to be on the forefront of collecting artifacts. I mean, there are several museums in this city which owe most of their collections to their collecting techniques.
Yeah.
The Laurentian Library and the manuscripts that it has from Cosimo and Lorenzo's time. There's a Natural History Museum which is filled with things, some of which no longer exist anywhere else, from the Americas when it was finally discovered.
Yeah.
Late 15th, early 16th century, and there's this portrait collection. I mean, this is became the most important collection or extensive collection of artist self portraits in the world.
Oh yeah.
So much so that artists were making self portraits of themselves and sending them as gifts to the collection to be represented there. Of course, the French artist Eugène Delacroix actually sent his own portrait and asked it to be hung next to his great rival. Eng, the very conservative French painter, as somehow a way of confronting him even in a gallery space in a museum in Florence.
And it still hangs in that same regard today.
They still hang together to this day. Originally, the collection hung in the galleries of the Uffizi, and it was moved to the corridor in the 1970s when they had restored and rebuilt it. However, it is sort of a testament to their innovation in ideas about what cultural objects mean, how they can be put together, and what you can sort of get out of them. That is sort of the legacy of this long-established duchy, of this family, the Medici.
It is super impressive, too. And then there's one last thing about the corridor. I do apologize, but I'm also fascinated by this. The one curve that it takes where they go around... what was real estate that they couldn't actually acquire because the family refused.
Right. There was a tower, I believe, of the Martelli family that still, even though these towers had been banned centuries before because what they represented was an older sort of mentality of Florentines before the Republic where the city had been divided up into these sort of gated communities that were at war with each other constantly. And this tower... existed right by the bridge, and obviously at one time they probably would have been collecting taxes of things going across the bridge through their property, I'm imagining. In any case, the Martelli refused to sell their property, and the Dukes had to do, is build their corridor around the tower, literally piggyback around it by putting brackets on their structure. One of the stories around this event is that the Duke himself, on coming to inspect the works as they were progressing across the bridge, began to have an affair with one of the daughters of the Martelli, which may or may not have happened,
right,
which may have led to their refusing to sell their land for a daughter who was now no more marriageable. That may or may not be true. I think the point being that it's much more interesting to tell stories about why these things matter than it is the actual sort of humdrum
Definitely.
Reasons for the politics involved. But what is really interesting for me as an urban historian is that if they refuse to sell, why would they allow them to actually build their structure onto the tower itself? And I think that has to do with a conception that that came about in legislation from the late Middle Ages, in which the city itself recognized your private property behind your walls of your home, for example. But what they did assume control of was the facade that you built, your sort of public face onto the city, and that they controlled through legislation, what we might call today aesthetic legislation, yeah. And that you had to maintain and keep that in proper accordance with the decorum of a beautiful city or square, for example. And in that case, even though you built your own walls, the outside image of that walls belonged to the city. And perhaps, therefore, that is why they were able to build right along the outside of the tower, which may not have technically belonged to the Martelli. That's just a theory of mine at the moment, because it's not exactly clear.
Well, it's completely plausible, because they are literally hanging the corridor.
They are literally hanging, because you can see the walls of the Martelli. I mean, it's yeah. just a box around the tower itself. Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. And so, Neil, a little bit more about you. Now, you're leaving Florence. You've been in Florence for 4 years now.
Sadly, I am leaving, yes.
Sadly leaving.
Almost 5 years.
Yeah.
Five glorious years.
It's wonderful. And so a little bit about where you're going. You're heading back to the States. You're going to be a professor, visiting professor, you mentioned.
That's correct.
At Texas Christian
University in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm looking forward to that a great deal. I'm looking forward to teaching, which is something I really love doing. In an academic setting. It's going to be a little bit different teaching in the classroom than actually on site. I've become used to standing in front of monuments, with monuments, in monuments, next to monuments,
right.
And actually being able to get students and anyone with me, you know, literally involved with right. with that in a very profound way, creating kind of a seminar kind of conversation around it. So it's a little different when you're showing a PowerPoint presentation on a screen. That's going to take a little bit getting used to, but I have to say, I mean, I was very, very lucky in that I was able to spend this much time here
yeah.
as a graduate student. On several fellowships to complete my studies. It also allowed me to hone my skills in talking about art to a range of audiences, right? From
sure.
you know those who are just art appreciation to those seriously engaged to the bored undergraduate, for example, and trying to show them why it matters to understand Florentine monuments and Florentine history. And so now, as my professor says, the golden years are over.
That's right. And let me say and compliment you on this regard. You are a wonderful guide, and it
Thank
was a
very
wonderful
much.
Tour.
It.
And if I could go back and take a class from you at Texas Christian, I would be happy to do so. I think it'd be wonderful. In context,
you're
very lucky
kind.
To have you for 4 years, and it was nice because I you really get a sense with you as the guide and describing things as you did and experiencing that. I know that Paul at Context believes very strongly in a very delicate approach to tourism. If you want to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll
sure,
wrap.
No, sure. Context is an extremely fabulous company to work with and for. They are very much interested in exposing, especially Americans, but anyone in the Anglophone world, to the history, the art history, the culture, the food, and the archaeology of this city and Italy, in particular. They're now expanding, of course, well beyond Italy. But to understand tourism not as a kind of a mass thing that one does because one has to or thinks one has, but to really to come to a place and really understand why this matters to you. Why does it matter for an American coming to Florence to understand what the David's doing standing out there?
Right.
Right. And so once you begin to understand that, you begin to understand the relationship Italians have to their history and to their culture and their food. You begin to understand the reasons why mass tourism is, a kind of a cultural, economic, and environmental problem. And I think the Context then offers ways out of that, right? And I think it's doing a great deal to enlighten people about the possibilities of other kinds
yes.
of traveling, which, of course, is extremely important, I think.
It's true, and it was a wonderful experience. And so thank you so very much for sitting down with us today, and not only for a wonderful job as a tour guide, but being a part of the interview today and helping
it's
people understand.
It's absolutely my pleasure. No,
it was great.
Thank you, Tony.
And I hope that we can connect. If we ever get down to Texas, I'll definitely look you up. We'll have an espresso down there.
I look forward to it, too.
It won't be as good, but we'll do it anyway.
Exactly.
So with that, Neil, thank you so very much. It was great having you on the show. And everyone, be sure to check out Context Travel. You can find them at Context Travel. There's two T's in the middle there, .com. And there are going to be links on howtotouritaly.com in case you're having a hard time spelling it to get back and check out all the wonderful tours and all the opportunities that Context provides you, not only here in Italy, but throughout Europe and even in the States now. So with that, thanks a lot, Neil. You were wonderful. And good
Thank
luck
you,
going
Tony.
Forward. Thanks
okay.
a lot, buddy. Ciao.
Dreaming of renting a villa in Italy? Papavero Villa Rentals, your Italy experts, will make that dream come true. We specialize in Italy 100% of the time. It's our passion and we love what we do. We're experts on travel to Italy and we're here to help you plan the perfect trip. From the Italian Alps to the beaches of Sicily, we personally select each property to assure your comfort. We travel to Italy multiple times a year to inspect and revisit each property to assure your physical comfort as well. We thump the pillows, check the water pressure, and sleep in the beds. We know each property intimately and are happy to help you choose the one that best suits your desires. And we don't stop there. Our frequent trips to Italy enable us to arrange day tours and services, all pre-approved by us, so you can book with confidence. No matter what your dream may be, a stunning villa with staff on Lake Como, a country cottage in Tuscany, a chic apartment in Rome, or anything in between, trust your dream to Papavero Villa Rentals. Call us toll-free at 1-866-737-0000. That's 1-866-737-0000. Or visit us online at papaverorentals.com.